Welcome to Cardicast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. This episode features Vic Gwynn in conversation with Andrew Kelly. Vic is the creator, curator of Culture Kid Digest, a monthly digest on culture in our lives. And at the time of recording, Vic was assistant curator of photographs, film and sound at the Australian War Memorial. Vic and Andrew discuss creating and running Culture Kid Digest and the need for diversity in glam.
Today I'm interviewing Vic Gwynn from Culture Kid Digest, among other things, I presume.
Yes, that's right. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. So, tell the world about you. And we'll get into the Culture Kid because that's the thing I'm really interested in.
Okay.
But yeah, how did you get here?
How did I get here? Oh, it's a bit of a long and a winding story, I think, like most people's are. So I was born in Brisbane, but actually grew up in Papua New Guinea.
Oh, wow.
And growing up in that environment really, I guess, exposed me from a very young age to different cultures, interacting with different people, history, and, of course, like the wealth of cultural heritage that's in Papua New Guinea from, you know, Cook's Swamp and archaeological finds to the wonderful people that are there, and of course to the Second World War's impact on the landscape. So I was very fortunate that, as I said, at a young age, I was kind of immersed in that environment and grew to love it very quickly. In Melanesian pidgin, like a wontok is kind of like an all-encompassing word for like friend or family or good connection.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate that one of my parents' closest wontoks had a great passion for history as well, in particular military history. And so he kind of took me under his wing and kind of brought it there. Coming back to Australia, I, of course, carried that passion through and did my undergraduate degree in archaeology and anthropology at University of Queensland, and then somehow found my way to Canberra, as I think most people do, and found myself looking towards getting into a cultural institution here to try and, I guess, build on that experience and passion and kind of get other people involved too.
Yeah. And where are you? Where have you ended up?
I'm now currently at the Australian War Memorial.
Oh, cool.
So
yep.
I'm an assistant curator of photographs, film and sound there. And I specialise in oral histories as well as looking at the material format or technique of the photographs that we deal with.
Was it the wealth of, like, you know, cultural heritage in Papua New Guinea that drew you in, or was it like your own natural instinct to come into that sort of realm?
Definitely that kind of two-pronged approach there. And, you know, my mum's Filipino Spanish, my dad's actually a Kiwi, and it's kind of this whole...
You've got a whole mixed melting pot,
And I guess that's another area of my interest is, I guess, that cultural identity. And often I think you find interest in and gain deeper meaning about yourself by exploring other things and finding where you fit in the world and your own personal identity and where you might want to go and what you might want to do.
You said that there was a strong connection to the war. And is that kind of what drew you to the Australian War Memorial? Or was it just like a happy coincidence that the two come together?
Again, a bit of both.
A bit of both,
yeah. Yeah, definitely from that young age. I mean, I don't want to sound cliche about it, but, you know, growing up with, you know, relics in the backyard or going for a Sunday drive with the family and you end up in Sugeri and, like, Kokoda Trail and stuff. So it was just kind of there.
Did you view it as, like, oh, this is a really interesting part of our history? Like, or is it is there a bit of a negative connotation to it? Or was it more of, like, this is really interesting and how does it fit into our wider culture and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I guess for me, and I don't want to sound like war doesn't have an impact, obviously it does, and definitely like the past 6 years working at the War Memorial has made me understand that a lot more and empathise with it and a lot more. But I guess because I was so young, and again, I think this is something that a lot of, I guess, third culture kids like myself might face, is that disconnect to cultures or perhaps where they might be at any one moment in time. And so I guess then I probably didn't quite identify as an Australian, even though born here, you know, Australian passport and everything. And having parents from different cultural backgrounds, which may have been impacted by the Second World War as well, it still wasn't a personal connection. So I did come from it from this very interested kind of, I'll hesitate to say forensic, but...
Yeah, yeah, that anthropological kind of...
Exactly, yeah, yeah, to try and understand things. And, you know, I mean, objects are cool, and obviously biased history is very interesting. And again, I think it's a part of finding out who you are, is to explore what's happened in the past. These things have interest me. Maybe if I follow a bit more down that road, I'll find out a bit more about it and maybe a bit more about myself.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's really cool. And this touches on a few things that I, especially that drew me to Culture Kid. So for, I only discovered Culture Kid Digest, like, I think it was 2-3 months ago.
Oh, well, it's still very early.
It's still very, it was issue 2 came out and I went, wow, how have I missed this? This is amazing. And then I was like, I need to talk to you. I need to interview you. So for those listening who don't know what Culture Kid is, do you want to explain what it is and how it came about?
Yeah, sure. So the Culture Kid Digest, and it sounds very naff. I've gone with an alliteration of K for culture.
Yep. I know it's,
apologies,
it's good.
There. Came about really, I think, from all of those experiences we've talked about trying to find sense of place and being, and also tying in that interest with the glam or galleries, libraries, archives and museums, bodies there, obviously working professionally in that too. So it had been bubbling away in my mind for a good couple of years. And I guess a lot of that interest came from the fact that sometimes as creative as the organizations you might work in or the work that you produce in it, there are obviously restrictions in what you might be able to explore, whether that's, you know, something outside of war and conflict. So it really came from my, I guess, wanting to connect with other people, wanting to see if other people shared similar ideas out there and if we could come together and start sharing those ideas and do it in as an inclusive way as possible. So we've started out as an e-digest, so electronic. Obviously, it's free for everyone to access. That's very important.
Very, very important, yeah.
And we're slowly starting to build up, I guess, that interest base, like wonderful people like you who stumble across it, which we're still trying to figure out at the moment. So it's really about being more inclusive and sharing those ideas, particularly within the glam community.
Yeah. It certainly has a very wide interest. Like issue one was more of an introduction to the whole thing, which was great. Issue 2 was the one that hooked me, and it was on
color and culture.
And I think it was there's three articles or blogs, and I was like, this is amazing. It's all stories about digital heritage and things from different perspectives that is other than white. And it was like, this is the voice we need to hear. This is what needs to get out. And I was like, yep, sign me up for the rest of this. But then as a reader, then I was like, oh, I'm waiting for issue 2 and, three. And 3 comes out and it's like, wow, we've now got a theme song because you've got, it's all about artists. And it's like just the wildly different topics is awesome. Like, and the fact that you've collected all that together, is that something you plan or is it like, oh, I just know some people?
A bit of both. So planning is great. I think we were talking off air a little earlier about how life just gets away from you at times.
Yes.
And this kind of happened with this upcoming issue 4, which will be released later tonight, which is my favourite thing. So a bit more eclectic. It's, again, a bit of like that thought bubbling process of why haven't we talked about this before? If not, why not?
Yeah.
Can we do that? And also about a bit of, well, yeah, there's this great person who's doing this and yet no one's talking about it. Why can't we talk about it? And trying to get that together. In terms of like the progression of themes, hopefully we'll continue to keep having themes that excite people and get them pulled in. And I think that's one thing we were really cognizant of, is not to try and, I guess, put people off that may not necessarily be already aware of the glam culture, to try and make it a bit more broader, have themes that people can connect to in some way or another, and then hopefully we can, you know, again share those ideas and then get people more interested in glam bodies and the work that we do, because I think a lot of people don't realize the power that cultural institutions have to affect change and to influence society and culture as well as politics. So
the thing I probably want to know is, like, Where's it going? What do you want to get out of it? Like, you know, and give, like, you know, kind of give back to the community as well.
Yeah. Well, as I said, kind of stemmed from that very selfish personal place. And it's still very, very new. So in terms of the future, hopefully there'll be growth. So hopefully we'll be able to get a far more diversity of people contributing from across the GLAM bodies and across different backgrounds as well, which would be absolutely fantastic. Looking towards having more of that advocacy approach to GLAM, as you said, like, having those voices heard is really important. I mean, I identify as, you know, a bi woman of color. And you know, it can be actually really hard to find another person who identifies as a person of color in these institutions. So it's about having more representation there, as you mentioned, and hopefully in the future with wider distribution of it, with wider knowledge of the Culture Kid Digest, and I guess some of the themes that we're trying to bring out is that people can have a voice, people can influence things that are going on in the GLAM bodies, bureaucracy notwithstanding. But it's really about starting small, having that grassroots approach, and allowing people to feel comfortable with the content, getting in touch with us, and hopefully growing from there. I mean, we're just a tiny baby. And as much as I'd love to see, you know, thousands of followers on
everything.
You've
got to start somewhere, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, hate to use this as a plug, but if
this is what it is. Hey, like, we're promoting it. That's great.
You know, if there are any people out there that are interested in contributing a short article, a review, an piece of art, anything would be great. It would absolutely be great, because we are looking to make sure that that diversification of the voices that talk about these topics is actually going to happen.
It's and it's allowing a safe space for those people to actually speak and be heard, and you know, it kind of really it's interesting, because it's the same kind of thing we're trying to do with the blog club, where it's, you know, the people who maybe don't blog or talk about, but they've got really interesting things. We're trying to encourage them to actually spread that knowledge around. And I think Culture Kid does that really, really well.
Thank you. And I guess on that, that's one thing. Technology can be quite off-putting. And when people hear a blog, they're like, oh, I don't know if I can do that. And that's like being that facilitator of being able to help people get their ideas out there in that safe space.
You're curating.
Exactly.
Like, you know, ideas and things like that, which is just something that we do. So the thing I really liked, especially, I think it was the F word theme, which was fun. I liked that you had an artist involved, which is... It was just a simple thing that I, you know, it's like, of course, we have galleries. Like, why aren't we talking to artists? Why aren't we getting their input about how things should be, you know, displayed and hung? And, like, is that the kind of thing that you're trying to influence as well? Like, you know, from the people whose collections maybe we hold, or...
Definitely. And I think, obviously, my experience has been very coloured by the fact that I work in a very traditional museum environment. And so for me, it's, again, a very selfish thing, but an opportunity to actually get out there and speak to people who are going through that creative process and to find out a lot more about them and have them actually involved in the display or of that content. So I think with the F word, we had three amazing people. Andy, there are two Andrews, so I'm going to do Andy Brazendale, who's the most amazing musician and producer who comes from Tasmania. And I've known him for a fair few years now. So I knew when coming up with that theme, I knew that I wanted to have people like him involved who aren't afraid to go through that creative process for something like this and then talk about it as well. Yeah. And so he gave a really wonderful, frank description of what his creative process was like, which I think, you know, especially when it comes to music and today in like Spotify and Pandora and things like that, you don't necessarily get that depth of understanding of what actually goes into creating a beautiful, creative piece of work.
Yeah.
And to understand that, and I think everyone likes a bit of a behind-the-scenes backstory. So we had him and Andrew Tennyson, who's a local Canberra photographer as well. Two very different mediums, two very different people, but obviously I think there were some of the same themes coming through.
What would be interesting is to see, you're talking about behind the scenes stuff, mm-hmm. like curating exhibitions and things like in libraries mm-hmm. and archives. There's a lot of work that, you know, all you do is you see, oh, wow, this is an amazing, you know, exhibition. Look at those didactics and things mm-hmm. like that. But the wealth of, like, you know, that creative process behind about yeah. finding images, about finding those stories and pulling them out. It would be, you know, interesting to see, like, you know, we've got the artists, but, like, having the stories from the people using the art and the archives and stuff like that.
Exactly right. And so I think we had Vanessa in that issue as well, who came from that, again, far removed from, like, the museum yep. feel, but from the art producer kind of background there, to give us a little bit of a glimpse into that. But that is one thing that hopefully we'll cover in upcoming issues, is that wealth of knowledge and creativity, but also I think a lot of the practical things that people don't realise actually is required to make an exhibition successful or a show successful, which is, you know, project management, yeah. time management skills, how to navigate a database,
yeah.
and that it's really a holistic project. And I know there's lots of articles out there, there's lots of commentary at the moment on how curators have to wear many different hats at the moment. I think that goes across the board for yeah. glam stuff
yeah.
in any institution though.
Which I think on Twitter, and every now and then we have this conversation about, like, what are we teaching people in, like, you know, at university, you're doing a glam course, like, what do you teach? And you're like, people in the industry start throwing out all these things like time management, project management, you know, curation, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, what is a core skill? Like, you know, mm-hmm. what can you not do anywhere else? But yeah, we put on many hats for what we do. And yeah. and I see, like, you know, you're working in a cultural institution like the War Museum. But then, like you said, you need that creative output. You need to, like, hey, there's these things that we could be doing or yeah. we are doing that no one notices.
This is a really interesting conversation. But that's one thing I found, like, I actually just started back at university to do my master's at the end of last year.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So when you're talking about, like, how are we teaching these glam skills for, like, a future generation of emerging professionals, I found it really interesting. And that's something that I'm trying to take into my work currently, is that there's the conflict between specialization and generalization.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's getting increasingly difficult to try and navigate between the two and what cultural institutions are requiring now. And of course, that's changing and changing and changing. That's just the nature of everything
yeah, yeah.
in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
But one thing I was really surprised with going back and doing my Masters of Museum and Heritage Studies at ANU, which I'm really enjoying,
oh, that's
so
good,
far,
yeah.
was that a lot of the skills that I take for granted that I do every day don't seem to be finding their way into a curriculum.
Yeah.
Which I feel, you know, it's a disservice to incoming students.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
you're expected to hit the ground running and have all
exactly.
these amazing skills that,
and
you know.
I know a lot of curriculum's being changed in a lot of tertiary institutions to address this.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's, again, so much more that institutions can do to support this. And I think it's about having, at least trying to understand, having that sustainable, like, succession planning in place, which is a challenge
yeah.
for cultural institutions. So understanding that in my own little ways, trying to address that. So whether it's, you know, a practical hands-on workshop that I'm running over the next couple of months to try and get people in. So there's opportunities there for people who are interested in glam, whether professionally or just out of their own personal interest, to come in and learn some of these skills and to get involved in ways they might not have thought were possible before. So there's that side
yeah, yeah,
to
no,
it as
yeah.
well, which I think I'm hoping, again, with the Culture Kid Digest, will help foster, you know, that there are alternative ways to learn these skills. Sometimes that's the unfortunate truth of wanting to get into this industry, because I think glam really is
yeah, yeah.
an industry, is to try and look outside the natural route of getting those skills from an internship or a tertiary course
yeah.
or volunteering, because there are other ways. And I think that's something that again, when we talk about hopefully where we are in the future a digest, that can be something that we're helpful with, that, you know, we can provide those opportunities.
Yeah. It's interesting because in my own, like, because I work in public libraries in WA, I recently wanted to run some crypto parties for the general public, and then suddenly realized that I'm the only person in my, you know, my library that actually knows what a crypto party is or how to run it. So I was like, I'll run some staff training. And then I went, you know what, I'm going to open that out to the other librarians in WA and say, come along to my training, I'll train you, you go back and train other people, and then we all have these things. Do you think that it's probably more these cultural institutions, the libraries, the galleries, museums, to go out and train these skills in like the new grads and also people, you know, who've been working in the industry for years? Do you think it's probably more like we need to take some ownership of that? Like, because you can't teach everything. Should we be fostering that community a lot more?
Definitely. Okay. Definitely.
I mean, I agree with that statement, but I wanted to...
And I apologise for putting on my little theoretical cap to have a bit of a rant. But I do feel that cultural or national collecting institutions, by their very nature of being publicly funded institutions, do have a responsibility to try and share these skills. Yeah. And I think if GLAM as an industry is to take its future seriously, and again, going back to that sustainable succession planning, there needs to be responsibility and ownership, as you said, taken of these things. And I think even though I wasn't able to attend the Emerging Professionals Museums Galleries Australia event that happened, I think, recently at the major conference in Brisbane, you know, some of the themes coming out of that and the topic of, you know, is a tertiary qualification really needed, are really pertinent. And I think it's governing bodies like Museums Galleries Australia that really also needs to drive this, to start implementing, you know, policies around, you know, how we're going to address these issues. Yeah. As an industry and as an Australian industry, you know, that also has ties to, you know, our neighbours in Asia and the Pacific, where we are able to, again, provide further upskilling and also have, like, those cross-institutional exchanges, I think, are really important. So, yeah, definitely agree. Institutions and I think our peak governing bodies really have a responsibility for that.
Like you said, there's a lot of knowledge and skills that maybe one person holds in a particular institution that no one else has. I mean, look, this is it's a problem across the board, like, you know, silos and all that sort of thing. But yeah, I like just listening to what you were saying, that Culture Kid is that, you know, you're like, you've gone, there's a problem. Someone should be doing something about this. And I was talking to a librarian in the US, and she said a really great quote: if you find a problem and you're like, no one's doing this, why is no one doing this? If you ask that question, you need to be the one doing that thing. In the same breath, she also said, I'm learning to say no, because you start finding those
things. It is very difficult to toe as I'm finding out.
Yes. I like this idea that we, you know, taking the reins of our own profession and, like, you know, like, okay, great, cool, you've got some really good core skills. Here's some more skills, go out, do some cool things, and let's support. Because that's the kind of point, like, I've got to that point where I'm trying to say no to things, you know, and you still end up doing 3 conferences and papers and whatever. But what I kind of want to focus on is, like, hey, you've got a really great idea, how can I help you do that? Do you see Culture Kid as a way of, like, finding those people and helping them out?
You've hit the nail perfectly on the head. Yes. And again, I think it's that relation to self, like, how did I find difficulties? Maybe there are other people who are experiencing difficulties, and if there's a framework there for them to be able to, you know, get their voice out there, get a short article that, you know, maybe they can put on their CV, or just have that experience of writing in a different style to what they might want to do in their day-to-day work, I think that's really, really important. And so I think I mentioned, like, facilitator before. Yeah. And that's one thing I've slowly been learning over this process too, because I'm WordPress, all that delight.
Yeah, yeah.
The technology, I'm not very good at it.
Delegation is the key. Well, I love delegation.
If there are any wonderful blog WordPress aficionados out there, please get in contact with me. I think it's, you know, as an editor, casting your eyes over those articles that you might get through or those ideas that people might want to explore, and encouraging them. And that's one thing I try definitely, unless there's great like grammatical error or flow to an article, is to leave it as it is, because that's someone's voice. And I think it's important to have that personal stamp on things. And I think that's one thing throughout my career with study and working professionally, is that you can appreciate your own voice a lot more and learn that it's, yes, there are certain styles for different types of writing, but your own voice is your own voice. Yeah. And I think that's something that people should be empowered to have out there, whether it's in the written form or in an interview or podcast or an artwork. I think that's really vital. And that's hopefully what we're trying to foster and coming across with the Culture Kid Digest, is that, you know, no matter what background you come from, how comfortable you are with different language, that your voice is just as important as another person's, and just as valid and just as interesting.
And sometimes even more so, because if your voice has never been heard before, odds are that, you know, we need to hear it.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
I know it's young, like, you know, we're only 3 and a bit issues, like, you know, has anything come from what you've already done? Like, you know, like, has someone gone, oh, this person is amazing, I've never heard them before, and, like, followed on or contacted? You know, it is early days, so, you know, I don't expect...
It is pretty early days, but I guess one of our fantastic contributors, I mean, they're all fantastic.
Of course, yeah.
Like, really appreciative to them. Karen Schamberger, she contributed one of the most fantastic articles about being mixed race.
Yes,
and navigating the museums that from Colour and Culture Issue.
That article was just amazing. Like,
it was fantastic. I actually came across, and I guess this is the wonder of social media and networks currently, across her PhD from like a closed Facebook group, and was starting to read it and like, this is amazing. This, I was wondering who or when people were going to do this, and someone has already done it.
Awesome.
So her amazing PhD thesis, which is an extension of the work that she did for her article with us. And I was just blown away that, you know, through the powers that be in the networking, and at that stage would be far tinier than what we are, that Karen was able to find us, and perfectly in time for the Colour and Culture edition, and sought us out to contribute. And that to me is hopefully a perfect example of where we'll be going in the future, is that, you know, people will find us and they'll be able to present their ideas to us, and it will just flow on from there. And since then, you know, Karen's provided me with a lot of resources that I'm able to take on in my day-to-day work, that I'm able to do with, like, my studies relating to advocacy and inclusion, particularly for people of colour and, obviously, like, third culture kids, mixed-race backgrounds. Yeah. These are, like, trending terms at the moment. So I think there's really that opportunity for further mentorship and friendships and that collegiate nature to really come through from something like this.
Yeah, yeah. Was she the one who mentioned the unwelcome wall?
Yes, that's correct.
That was, if you haven't, go read the article after this, but it was just a wonderful twist, and it kind of resonated with me because it was based on the Welcome Wall, and I think in the Fremantle Museum.
Yes, and I think there's a sister one to it at the National Maritime Museum in Sydney as well.
Ah, right, yeah. But I saw Perth and I went, hey.
Connections.
You know, like, hey, finally we're, you know, getting mentioned. But then that twist of putting a different spin on something, it totally changes everything, and you're like, wow, we need to be doing this more. I think because that issue really resonated with me, like, there was a lot of really good stuff in there. How do you feel the impact of race and gender as well, and sexuality and things like that on our GLAM institutions? Do you know, is there a lot more work to be done? Do we need more people who, you know, have different backgrounds looking at exhibitions, making exhibitions, you know, that sort of thing as well?
You're definitely touching on, like, a very dear to my heart kind of topic here. I do tick off a few of those minority boxes.
Yeah.
And I think definitely diversification, particularly within the GLAM bodies, is so important. I think having that representation there, I mean, if you're a young child that's just come to Australia and or growing up here, you know, when you go to your museum, when you go on your, I think, grade 6 trip to Canberra and come to the major institutions, Do you see yourself reflected in these exhibitions? Do you see stories similar to you and your families? I think that's really important. I was looking at some of, doing a bit of research lately, again, because this is a very dear topic to my heart and hoping to extrapolate it on later, is that, you know, numbers of diversity in cultural, national cultural institutions in particular, can be really difficult to find out, you know. Mm-hmm. Annual reports, you know, with those statistics of called or born in Australia, parents born in overseas, there's a real disconnect between the terms there, making it harder for visibility of people who do identify as coming from, you know, a multicultural background, who might identify as LGBTIQ, and whether those are even sought after statistics is something that's not being done. And if it has, it's not being done in perhaps the most easiest or transparent, not the quite the right word, but the most accessible manner possible. And so what I found going through those reports was that national cultural institutions, and obviously this is just from skimming through, so not hard fact by any means.
Citation needed.
You know, that we're still lagging behind in diversity and inclusion for staff members in these cultural institutions, to be able to do things like that, to be able to advocate for voices that might not necessarily be heard normally, not out of spite or agenda, but just because, they're not included, they're not there. So, you know, it's not something that would naturally spring to mind.
Yeah.
So also, interestingly, looking across the Australian public service data, because national cultural institutions here are Australian and public service, it seems that there's, again, a bit of a lag in terms of diversification in staffing populations compared to the rest of the APS. And I guess that's partly because of, when we were talking about that succession planning, it's so hard to get a job in GLAM. It's really competitive and really difficult. So you don't really have that amount of movement and job openings available. So it's already a really difficult industry to get into. So when you think about all of the challenges that people of colour might face, people with, you know, different language backgrounds might face, you know, in choosing to have a career in GLAM and then being able to get through the tertiary hurdles, it's even more challenging. And so if we can start having representation in exhibitions and publications, you know, we can start to change that kind of landscape to have people come in and say, well, actually, you know what, I do want to visit this museum because I think it would be interesting and I think I would have a space there that I can feel safe and feel part of and be represented and see that reflected back. So I think that's really important.
We obviously need more representation, but we also need to talk about it more.
That's the thing, we definitely need to be talking about it more. And again, hopefully Culture Kid comes off as a forum for that, like an opportunity for people to do that. But I think, talking about it, people, I think, might be these days so afraid of being called a racist as opposed to actually talking about racism, which is, I think, completely different things. And I can't speak for everyone, obviously. But I think a lot of people out there would just be really appreciative if people were interested in talking about this, asking questions. Yes, they might be difficult questions, but they should be questions that should be asked nevertheless. And of course, doing that in a respectful way. Because I think if it can't always be the onus of people who are marginalized, who are minorities, to try and push for this change. And I think that's one thing that might happen. And I know Karen, who wrote that fantastic article, you know, she talked to me about it, as well as having that fatigue of having to deal with these things and having to try and affect change. And I think that's where allies are so important to come into that discussion. So you have as many voices as you can being heard. And I think that's one thing I've certainly found in trying to make subtle changes, is that nothing's going to happen overnight, obviously. But if you can affect some change, you know, that goes a long way. And personally, professionally, and for other people, and you know, just having this conversation with someone else right now can be incredibly reaffirming that, you know, you're not crazy, you're not alone.
What can our cultural institutions and our employers do to actually help and be a good ally and advocate?
There's a wealth of things that can be done. As I said, I don't think realistically change will, you know, overnight there'll be 50% of the workforce will be diverse. Yeah. But there are small things that institutions are currently doing and should be currently doing, and whether that's, you know, diversification of their workforce, whether it's you know, quotas. You know, I know there's a lot of criticism about affirmative action. But sometimes you do need to meet that. You do need to implement that to be able to allow people to get around those hurdles, because otherwise there's a catch-up, there's a disconnect of so many years and so many, you know, differences that it's just not going to be possible if we're going to see real change and real difference in our exhibitions and in our workforce. So that's, I think, one thing that should be looked at, discussions like this, you know, particularly with allies, in your saying when you're not comfortable with something, why actually saying it. I'm giving advice, and I know sometimes it can be so hard to actually do this because I found it difficult myself, but if you can find your voice to say, no, hold up guys, that's actually not cool, you know, I have a look at it this way. And I think empathy has a lot to do with that, and being able to personalize these stories and these experiences is incredibly powerful. And so I think museums really need to employ more empathetic approaches to how they're working within workforces, and of course in the content that they're producing to put out there, is to have, you know, just stories of people who might identify as marginalized alongside, you know, more mainstream stories, and show that, you know, these are people too, they're not that different. And again, it comes back to having that power, that social power there to affect change more broadly. And so if you start to see stories like that in your exhibitions and in your publications, and you can empathize with them and have those allies there, then you start to have that change in societal, you know, perception of what constitutes a dominant narrative and what's a marginalized narrative. And hopefully that in the future, there won't be any talk of this. It'll just be like, you know,
it's just a thing.
This is just someone's story up against, you know, with someone else's story.
Yeah.
And I think there's great power in that empathy. And again, I don't want to get on my little policy high horse. I think, you know, sometimes people think that, you know, pink bodies like MGA aren't that powerful, but they actually are. They can do a lot. And so I think if you really care about this, get involved with those pink bodies. You know, you don't have to project your ideas straight away, but get involved, learn about them, learn how they function, learn how legislation in Australia works for things that impact the cultural heritage sector and cultural institutions, and start learning about those things and where you can make effective and tangible change, if that's possible. And in those areas that you can't make those changes yet, you know, hopefully in the future we can work towards that and try and implement that framework now to support that future work.
It's all very well and good for cultural institutions to tell the story, you know, like to help showcase stories of especially Indigenous history and things like that, as well as marginalised people. But a lot of our collections and our archives and, you know, libraries, they've all been written by white colonial Australia, you know. Do you feel that, you know, like getting more voices in GLAM will help that? Or is it getting people in with those different backgrounds to pull out the stories from around those collections?
I think most certainly there needs to be presence from diverse people within these institutions. And I think if diverse people or marginalized people in these institutions can drive those changes, more so the better.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing worse than feeling like you're being spoken for and not actually having your voice heard.
Because there's a difference, a very key difference between doing an exhibition about a particular group of people and an exhibition by a particular group of people, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Right. And so I think there's definitely room for growth in those areas. And I think it's chicken and egg kind of situation. Yeah. Like, our allies who don't identify from these marginalized demographics are really important. I don't think people realize the power of the exhibition and having that voice, because there's always a voice that's present in that exhibition. That's what the theme is about.
Yeah.
You know, that's how the story has come about for that exhibition, is someone's, you know, voice and projecting that through. So we do need to have people there that identify. How we go about it is a bit more tricksy. As you said, we can't go back and we can't redress all of the wrongs and collecting failures of the past. But what can we do now? And so I think, as you said, having that call to action, having people who are interested that might necessarily not want to get involved because of this, I think trying to address that, trying to encourage people to come in and get involved is really important. Write letters saying, why don't we have this? Can we have this? To actually show that there's interest out there. I think a lot of the times cultural institutions work in a little vacuum. They might know their main target audience and be able to produce the content directed towards that. But often they might miss out on huge amounts of people that would be interested in content if they could tailor it in a different, if they had their voice heard, if there was a little, even just a little bit more representation there. And so I think it's also the responsibility of institutions to actually do that far-reaching research and engagement. It's to find out, you know, what can we be doing better, you know, because there is interest out there. And I think the amount of films that have come out, I think in the past 18 months even, that have lead cast members that are from diverse backgrounds. I think there was a very brief study that came out in the last couple of days that showed that these films, on general, outperform the films that just have a white mainstream cast. And that's shown in box office returns as well. So I think cultural institutions need to be aware that that interest is out there and people will engage with it if they produce that content and if they can do so respectfully.
Yeah.
And I think that's, hopefully slowly being heard.
There's only a few problems to fix. You know, we'll have it done by the end of this podcast. Yeah. It'll be great. But as you were speaking, I was earlier, I was like thinking of Wonder Woman, Black Panther, because pop culture is my thing as well. And also like the fact that in my own reading habits, I've got very bored of your mainstream Marvels and DCs, and I'm only reading, female-led, comic series, independents, trying to get that diverse stories. Like, that's basically all. And that's what we do in GLAM, isn't it? We tell stories and save stories and that sort of thing.
Exactly right. And that's the thing. If a story can be told with that person's own voice, with their own experience, with their own inflection, no matter what format it comes out in, then it's all the more so powerful. And it has far greater reach than just a didactic that's written.
That is something that GLAM institutions have to navigate. Like, mm-hmm. it's like, you might find a story really worthwhile highlighting and you're like, but having that first thought that, maybe I'm not the best person to tell this story. And then going and finding that person.
That's exactly right. And I think also being able and confident and feeling supported to take risk. Because there are certain things that some institutions might find risky that other institutions can do quite freely. And so it's about taking that risk. And of course, you need to be able to have that institutional support behind it. But I think that's also where it comes back to doing your own research and looking into your, the acts that surround the work that you do and actually seeing, we are supposed to be telling the story of all Australians, of everyone. This is just one of those stories. And so it does fit. And it can be really scary. But I think if you don't, you certainly get left far behind as an institution, and whether you're relevant or not anymore. A technological age where it's so fast-paced is really important to make sure that you're relevant, that you're meeting those audiences, and in doing so that you can actually do something really meaningful as well.
Yeah. I think the key word that you just mentioned was risk. And it's like the fact that telling these stories might be considered, and air quotes again, risky. Like, that should be an alarm bell for a lot of institutions, shouldn't it? Like, that should be them going, wait, why is this risky, when it's actually the people who live here? It's, you know, the people who make up Australia. These are their stories. Why should that be risky?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think there's risk associated with pretty much everything, but it's that perception of risk. And I think, you know, sometimes you just have to wear it.
Yeah.
You just have to wear it. Like, as much as I like to think that museums are safe spaces, inherently they're not. There's always going to be one voice or one person or one community that feels alienated or disconnected from whatever content is produced. That's, I think, just the nature of the world in general and human nature. So you have to do that risk assessment. Yes, we alienate, well, hopefully not, but you know, we might come up with challenges against this idea because of XYZ risk. But again, what are the risks if we don't? We're going to be disengaging with a new generation where, you know, and it's a wonderful time to be, despite all of the problems that the world is going through at the moment, you know, where people are starting to become far more aware of diversity, of LGBTIQ issues, and being more inclusive, even in the language that we use every day, which is so important. So if you don't engage with those, air quotes again, risky topics, you run the risk of disconnecting from your future target audience. And employees, exactly right. So, I mean, I know it's a fine line to try and tread, but I think, you know, where possible, people should be trying to engage with those risks. And again, it can be really difficult because sometimes it's just not possible with the way, you know, exhibitions are structured, or, you know, the way a museum is structured, or resources that are available. I mean, practicalities speaking, you know, sometimes it will be slow going. But again, that flip side, if you don't, there's again risk.
I think that's a really good thing to take away. Mm-hmm. It's like, what is the risk of not doing this? Mm-hmm. A lot of what you're saying also fits with our, you know, the New Cardigan, our motto, which is JFDI. I just like the idea of just go out, just do it. And like, which group is actually, you know, considering this risky, or, you know, like getting the pushback is like, are they the people that you need to engage with?
Or are they the people that you can hopefully change their minds about
something?
And, you know, with a bit of feedback from them, being a bit more empathetic, because I mean, people do have genuine concerns and stuff, and if you have the power to try and, you know, address those concerns and actually say, hey, you know, it's actually, they're just people, then I think that's again another amazing power that cultural institutions have, to be able to do that, and do that in more subtle ways than I think a lot of people might think.
There was a particular Twitter thing that I was reading. It was where a particular director was like, oh, we can't have an African-American soldier in this scene because they didn't... It didn't...
I think Doctor Who.
Was it Doctor Who?
I think... Cause I yes, think it was. I read it was Moffat. Same thing, a Victorian-era soldier who was black.
Who was black, But it was... And it shouldn't have to come to that point, but it was like, oh, there was actual archival, you know, knowledge. There's a lot of... it's not pressure, but it's a lot of responsibility for archival institutions and for galleries and museums to have those voices out there, so that a black soldier in Victorian era is, oh, yeah, no, of course, yeah. I saw an entire exhibition about that, you know?
And I think that's exactly right. You know, we... I think we can even do it like a closer-to-home example with, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait diggers who served throughout the Great War, the First World War, the Second World War, and so on, who had to hide their identities to even be able to enlist. I think that's, you know, a perfect example of that, where archives and museums are now working to redress the silencing of their voices. You know, and it can be incredibly difficult, like looking through archival material and primary historic objects to be able to even find out if someone was Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander because they had to hide their identity to enlist. And so there's that imposed denial of who these people are because they wanted to serve their country, the steps that they had to go through to do that. And so it is a challenge, I think, for anyone working in GLAM to try and be involved with that just because of the sheer nature of the historic silence that was imposed. But that doesn't mean we can't do it, and we are doing it, and I think a lot of people are doing it really well.
I've also seen the same with queerness in like historical photographs and like, you know, oh, their hands are touching, is that, you know, like,
an
is that code, is
that,
you know, and you've got to kind of like, it changed the way I started looking at things. It's like, am I looking at things through a heteronormative lens? Now I'm going to be like looking at soldier photos because, you know, I'm like, wait, you know, is this person Indigenous? Did they have to hide their identity? Like, rather than just presuming.
It's far more interesting to lead a life where you can see all of these different points. It makes things so much more interesting and fun and engaging to be able to do that. And I think if things like New Cardi Cast can do that, and Culture Kid, and people who are listening to this who want to get involved can do that, I think we're in good stead to have a really great future as an industry.
Especially and with people like yourself.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Thank you.
It's great. And again, you know, Culture Kid Digest is really in its infancy, so we really appreciate it. Anyone who wants to get involved, we're interested in sharing your voice and your experience and your interests. So please feel free to contact us.
Yeah, we'll put the details up on the website. But do you want to just give a quick plug of your URL and, you know, emails and things like that?
Yeah, so you can have a look at the Culture Kid Digest on culturekiddigest.com. That's culture with a K. And again, you can contact us at culturekiddigest@gmail.com, again with a K. We've also got an Instagram. Really exciting. We've got a great person who's also attending NLS 8 doing an Instagram takeover for us over weekend. Libby Alvey from University of Queensland. So we're really excited to have her do that. And you can follow us on Instagram at Cult Kids, again with a K.
Excellent. And you've got a Facebook as well, I
believe? We do, yes. So just type in Culture Kid Digest.
Use your library skills or, you know, your...
You got this, guys. Feel free to get in touch with us in any of those platforms. We try to be as responsive as possible, and hopefully in the future we'll be able to roll out some in-person meetings, some catch-ups, maybe some tours of some places as well.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and, you know, it's a very impromptu podcast, but thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Vic Gwynn, creator-curator of Culture Kid Digest, in conversation with Andrew Kelly. You can check out Culture Kid Digest on Facebook and Instagram. We hope you've enjoyed this interview and would love you to review us on iTunes. It does help other people to find out about CardiCast and lets us know we're on the right track. Keep an ear out for more CardiCasts. Check out our website at newcardigan.org for more events. And always remember, folks, JFDI.